Each failure is a step closer to success. You're listening to episode 11 of Learn With Us. I am Ken.
And I'm Nikos. Learn With Us is a podcast for developers that want to be better programmers.
That's right. I want to be a better programmer. And today we're going to talk about writing vanilla JavaScript. And what that means is what, Nikos?
It means using the platform and having minimal helpers and abstractions on top of what the DOM JavaScript APIs and just JavaScript give you outside of the box.
Right. One of my driving principles of software development is to always have fewer lines of code is better. And if you can abstract or you can use some other library to bring it in, then the fewer of your lines of code do you need to test. However, a lot of times when you're bringing in third-party libraries, you're bringing in all of their bugs into your application. So you have to be aware of what you're bringing in. So a lot of times it is easier to bring in third-party libraries, but it also does introduce a lot of complexity.
Right.
It's one thing to bring in something like jQuery to make your workflow a little bit better, but it is also, I think, wiser from a developer standpoint to know what jQuery is doing under the covers. Take a look under the hood, see what it's doing, and take the pieces of jQuery that you want, or Lodash, or whatever other utility, and write that into your software, and rather than make a hard dependency on a third-party library.
Yeah. I think as soon as you bring in any framework to a project, you immediately make things a bit more tricky for a developer that you're working with who doesn't know that framework. But you can get that developer up to speed pretty quickly if you mentor them or just guide them in how to use the framework as it is. You know, yesterday I was starting the front-end project for a social network that I'm building, and I had most of the morning I was thinking about whether to use React or Ember or just vanilla JavaScript. Well, vanilla JavaScript, helped by vanilla TypeScript.
You weren't choosing Backbone with Marionette?
Nah.
Or Knockout? You weren't going old school? Yeah.
Nah.
Yeah, I mean, that's the challenge, right? What framework do I use? And, in the terms of, React versus Ember, those are two different things that have a completely different, architecture. React is very, do whatever you want as long as it, you can throw props at it or whatever. Whereas Ember is you got a very opinionated framework that you have to do it the Ember way. And if you wanted to go with something that's, vanilla, you essentially are writing your own framework.
Yeah.
However, all the code is there in one place, and it's easy to make those changes as needed when the moment arises that you need a certain feature in your app.
Yeah.
Depending on a third party library, you're stuck with when are they going to update the fetch API or are they going to introduce promises into this library? Well, you don't have to worry about it if you write your own.
Yeah. The reason that I chose Ember is that I just didn't have to think about all the stuff that I would have to have thought about if I was using React. How am I going to run my integration tests? How am I going to mock a backend?
It definitely allows you to kind of offload a lot of that infrastructure to the framework. Whereas if you write your own or you take React, which is obviously a lighter framework, you end up having to do a lot of the heavy lifting on your own, for sure.
Yeah. And like every few week, every like week, there's a sort of a new, you know, way to do, use React, a new library, and I mean Ember. All anyone who's worked on Ember immediately can understand what the other Ember developers are doing and how they go about things. So it's like, even though there's less Ember developers out there, the ones that do use it have sort of chosen it for a reason, and it tends to be good reasons that they've chosen.
Yeah, it's super stable, and I think we mentioned in a previous episode that, you know, when they deprecate, you know, features of Ember, it's not a surprise. It's like they give you enough warning before they can pull it out. So
yeah.
I can see the appeal of going with a robust framework like Ember, or even Angular for that matter, like having something that's going to, you know, move you from, you know, an idea to a completely full-fleshed app, you know, in a matter of weeks. Whereas, you know, if you wrote your own, or you went with React, it might take you longer. But at the same time, like I said, the code that you write in a vanilla JavaScript or a vanilla TypeScript application is going to be your code. You're going to know exactly how it works. And you don't need to depend on third-party libraries. And that's actually going to lower your footprint, like on, you know, the files that get shipped to the browser are going to be a lot smaller because they're exactly what you need.
Yeah. So I thought about using, you know, stitching together my vanilla TypeScript warp router project, which is like a 120 line router. But that is just a very basic router. It has like the warp router class, and it has a route class, and the route is actually, it takes three parameters. Let me just pull it up here on my computer. So, like, a route has like a function that you run when you first enter the route, and it has a second parameter that says, like, let me just pull up. So, that's locally. So, like, the router has like three parameters, like an initial function to run, which generates any content that you want to add to the selector or the router is added to. But what the way the router is made is it uses the vanilla TypeScript iAttachable component, which says, give me a piece of an element on a page and attach this component to it. And what the warp router does is that it will then insert the content generating functions for each route that is called on a particular hash the user enters. And there's also like a second routing function that the user can execute when they return to the route for the second time. So the route itself is like managing its state and remembering things, you know. And that leaves the actual main class kind of, this all this is, handles the hash changes, but
okay,
yeah.
So internally, when you're saying there's a selector that this route gets attached to, like, are you using like things like document.querySelector?
Yes, query selector. Yeah, it's actually part of the vanilla TypeScript interface for a iAttachable component.
So, an iAttachable component is something that you've defined in your application.
Yeah, so it's an interface with two methods. One method's called attach, and it takes as a parameter the selector, and it returns a promise when the element is finished initializing. A lot of times, they're just immediately executed synchronous promise functions. There's no delay, but all the components do return a promise so that any any consuming library knows how to just work with these components.
Right. It's not, you don't have to potentially worry about race conditions. That's solved with the promise.
Yeah. And the idea is eventually I'll have enough of these vanilla types of components that I can compose them together quite easily. And so that, in a sense, well, you could say it's a framework, but they're so vanilla-like that they don't really have to be used in any certain way. In fact, they can be used in any framework, or it's just designed to be used everywhere.
Kind of standalone, piecemeal type stuff.
Yeah. So like
that's the nice thing about, you know, these small modules is that you can have these really small and self-contained components.
Yeah.
That can be used across all sorts of applications.
Yeah, like for example, I'm going to use the warp router on my own website just to give, at the moment, quantumjs.com is just a single page with some vanilla TypeScript components used for the forms and the grill type notifications. But I want to add some blog posts on there. So I'm going to basically use the warp router to have a function for a different hash on the URL, and then there I'll have the component that basically reads the MD files on the static backend and just render them. So the warp router will be sort of just for my own sanity, you know, the standard way to handle hash changes and render content.
Yeah. Cool. That kind of reminds me back in the day. I can't remember what it was. It was using jQuery to essentially prefetch. You'd have a static HTML page or static HTML website, and then you'd have six different tabs on that website, and each tab was a hidden div, but the tab was a link to another page, and jQuery would go out and prefetch the URL content for all of the six tabs.
Yeah,
and load it in the background in the div, load the content in the div.
Yeah,
I just remember that it's like, oh, that it. This was before routing was a thing, but we would do weird tricks like that where we'd just go and Ajax the href, load the content, the document body content into a div, and call it a day.
Yeah, that sounds you go.
No, go ahead.
So, in a sense, I don't really feel like I'm rewriting the book here, because, you know, under the hood, jQuery is a really big, complicated thing, and I'm willing to take a little bit of a performance hit just for the simplicity aspect of what I'm trying to do here. Like, when I use this warp router thing on my own website, you know, all the complexity about downloading the MD file and, you know, rendering it to the page will be done within a user supplied function to the route. So there's none of that complexity inside of the route itself. The route on the warp router library, the route TypeScript class, they're actually just super super basic. But they're so flexible.
Know that anything about how it's being used, right? It's like it's dumb compared to. Like the consumer of it is the smart part.
Yeah, that's what I try to do with all my code, really. Like even the vanilla TypeScript solar pop-up, that just takes user supplied functions, and you can do anything you want with the thing.
Yep. Yeah, that's the best way to do it. Abstract that stuff away, the core library for that router is going to be. Really small, but it's going to be very powerful, and you can drop it into anything pretty much.
Yeah, I mean, I don't make these things just for a technical exercise. I make them to supply a real world need, which is my need. Yeah.
Cool.
What was the inspiration to make the vanilla TypeScript? Because I'm lazy or something.
I would say, Nikos, you're not that lazy if you're writing your own framework.
Yeah, and I guess now, so.
I know you're going to say, I'm not writing a framework, I'm writing a component. But you know what? When you compose a whole bunch of components together, you've got a framework. And you know what? I don't... That, even though we're talking about vanilla JavaScript and vanilla TypeScript, you trust the code that you write because it's your code, and you can make edits and changes whenever you need to. And that's kind of what I'm talking about, where, yeah, I like to use third-party libraries because I can not have to test that stuff. But at the same time, when I do bring in a third-party library, I'm bringing in a lot of risk because if they're not testing the things that are important to my application in the framework, then my app's not going to work. So it's definitely something that I need to be cognizant of because I want to make sure my apps work.
Yeah. Yeah, I could really recommend vanilla TypeScript to companies at the moment, you know, but, you know, if they want to use it, then they can use it to make their own vanilla TypeScript components.
Yeah, there's a lot of value in writing their own library or own framework, especially if they have like a whole suite of applications and they want to kind of spin things up from kind of these base components.
It would be a
good amount of value for them to have their own kind of core library.
So you've been doing some vanilla JavaScript yourself these days, haven't you?
Yeah, so I've been doing a lot of document.querySelectorAll, some custom events handling. We're not dependent. We don't have any sort of frameworks that we can bring into our application. It's not really an application more. It's a kind of just a small little library that we have. And we're just kind of like a utility that sits on top of the Nike website. So we can't really bring in things that we, you know, like Lodash or other huge frameworks that would help us. So we gotta be slim. We gotta keep our profile low, so that we can not slow down the rendering of the main application. So any millisecond that's shaved off of the website speed is another, you know, dollar lost.
Is the Nike website quite a big and complicated site as it is?
There's definitely some complicated pieces. We're in the middle of a conversion to React.
Oh, so, right.
Most everything on the site is server rendered pages through Java server. So, but everything else is kind of leaning towards becoming a React app. So, that's what we're focused on right now. But I'm not in any of those groups. I'm definitely not writing React code right now.
Yeah. Have you used React before?
I've taken Wes Boss's course on Redux.
Yeah.
Which I didn't take his React for Beginners course. I just jumped into the Redux course because it was free, and I mostly wanted to get an idea of what Redux was doing because I wanted to bring it into my Angular world, but never did. Anyway, the course he had was fun, good, liked it. And then just a couple of weeks ago, I installed Create React App.
Oh yeah,
and that was easy. I got a React app running, but I don't look at the code. I have no idea what it's doing.
Yeah,
so, I'm very fresh. I'm un tainted by React. I don't have any real opinions on it.
Yeah. I haven't wrote a big enough React app to be able to see the advantage of the whole Redux thing, you know. I mean, I do find that it takes quite a while to get, you know, all the boilerplate up and running. You just have to write all these functions, and there's, you know, dispatch to props and map state to props, and that takes a bit of a while to get your head around.
Yeah. I tried to think about it for bringing it into an Angular app, and, you know, there's this other thing called NGRX, and it kind of does the same thing. I think it's actually might be a fork of Redux. I'm not sure. And I just couldn't get my head around it. Couldn't figure it out. Like, what does this serve? What purpose does this serve? And how do I use it? But, you know, I imagine at some point I'll figure it out or take the time to figure it out.
Yeah.
I'm not there yet. But, yeah, I mean, my day-to-day work doesn't require me to think that way, so I'm not going to until I need to.
Yeah. So the rest of this week I'm knee-deep in AWS learning about Cognito, which is the whole, like, user authentication system that AWS is doing. I kind of, like, was holding off jumping into this stuff because I knew it was going to take me ages to learn. But I found an amazing tutorial, which is for, like, it's like 300 pages long, but it's called, like, serverless-stack. And it's such a great tutorial because it's got screenshots for absolutely everything you do. So there's no ambiguity, and it really helps.
Cool. Yeah, I was... wanting to get into serverless a little bit more. I don't know how to... I haven't quite figured out, like, when to use serverless versus when to use, a virtual private server. That's still, questionable to me. Like, do I just use... If I wanted serverless, would I just use it for, an endpoint, posting data, or would I guess virtual private server would be if I had an actual website I wanted to serve.
Yeah.
So I started playing with AWS Lightsail. I guess that's just a virtual private server that you can mess around with, Linux based. Kind of easy to get set up.
Yeah. I think it's with the serverless, you're just wanting to not have to pay for anything that you're not using. And you just want to have these business logics that are wrapped up to Lambda that just get spun up when they're being used, you know.
Yeah, but would you say that you could put a full Node Express app up on a serverless? Like, if I had multiple routes in my Express app, or would that be not the right fit for it?
Well, Lambdas are more for single page apps.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could use them. You can use them for anything, but you're not going to have server rendering like you would have with, Express.
So if I had a Ember, a React or Angular app, as long as it was a single page app. Serving an index.html with some JavaScript, that would be okay for Lambda.
Yeah, you're using the Lambda functions. Like, you can use them as a. Well, actually, a lot of the functions are behind API Gateway on Lambda, which is you can make that your RESTful API. The API Gateway sits in front of Lambda, and it passes on events to Lambda. Lambda works as it has sort of a contextual function so that it gets spun up on an event, and that can events can be pretty much many different things. So that's why the AWS type doesn't have any TypeScript types for the event, but the context is the sort of environment it runs in. So that's got a type, and then you've got this callback as well, which you run when you finished your Lambda function. The callback is actually an AWS SDK type as well.
Yeah, so, I'm just looking up the Lambda website. So, yeah, they say online order is placed. DynamoDB stores it. That triggers Lambda, and then Lambda does some stuff.
Yeah.
Or a photo is taken. S3 bucket has the photo uploaded. Lambda is triggered, and then it does a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, I guess other services within Amazon could trigger Lambda to spin up.
Yeah, they can respond. There's a whole host of things.
Or maybe like a user visits a URL, and would that trigger the Lambda? I guess it's got HTTP endpoints.
Yeah.
So that would be yes. So the HTTP endpoint would be triggering Lambda.
Yeah, in the serverless framework, you've got this YAML file, and you have this function in the YAML, and it is handled by this API endpoint.
We'll have to get an expert on here.
Yeah.
I think we got somebody in the pipeline.
Yeah, we do.
Come on, teach us more. Cool. So, are you giving any talk? You're giving talks on serverless soon.
Yeah, right? I've given a couple actually. Believe it or not. Yeah. Cool. As long as you know more than the people you're teaching about a subject, then you can teach them, because they don't know what you don't know.
Yeah, that's true.
I've got a webinar coming up for eSynergy Solutions, and that's I think that's on the 6th of October. So preparing for that, I've also got a university that is kind of interested in rolling out my social network, believe it or not, once it's sort of done in a very informal basis. Yeah.
Is it going to be the Facebook.net?
Well, I don't think this is going to be as popular as Facebook, but it's very niche.
Facebook released only to Harvard when, you know, it was just brand new. So.
Yeah. I mean, the idea behind it is pretty much going to be about, you know, students helping other students, you know, or just people helping other people.
Crowdsourcing homework.
I don't think they'd roll that out.
If I were a college student, I'd definitely be signing up for that.
Outsourced to India, Eastern Europe.
You might want to restrict by geolocation, like where they can access it.
Yeah. Outsource your exam.com, you know. Webcam to your exam papers, and then this person talking to you in the earphone. Yeah, this is the answer.
yeah, that would be it. Cool. Well, all right. Well, I think we reached the end of our ramblings today. So, yeah. Where can people find us online, Nikos?
Now you're talking. So, if you go to learnwithus.simplecast.fm, that will get you the online version. And you can also go on iTunes, you can find us on Learn With Us. And we appreciate 5-star reviews on iTunes.
Yeah, and sometimes we tweet and sometimes we don't, but we're on Twitter at Learn With Us Pod. And most times we don't tweet, but you might find something there.
Yeah.
With that, thank you so much for listening. We appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. See ya.
Bye.
Bye.